looking at removing deer this winter at some level. At some level, that we'll define probably towards the end of this week, if not the first part of next week, looking at numbers of samples to get an idea of apparent prevalence. So, in other words, we found a positive. We're going to go out and sample some deer across the more broader landscape, probably within 5 or 10 miles of the infected deer, and get an idea of what we're looking at with respect to positive deer on the landscape. Then we'll be looking at a deer feeding ban in a more broad area as a way to control the spread. And I see Senator Scully nodding his head, like similar to what we did in bovine TB in that area, and be looking at short-term reductions in deer densities with cooperation from landowners. Trying to get a sense for what are we looking at with respect to deer infection rates across the landscape. But that's all I figured I'd share with you today. I certainly have a lot more information. There's a lot in that handout. But just wanted to put it on your radar that we did find a positive deer, and our plan kicks in looking at trying to deal with this disease on the landscape.
Mr. Cornicelli, a question that I have, the 525 deer samples, that's all voluntarily, isn't it? That's been going on for some time by the program from the DNR?
Mr. Chair, yes. We've been doing chronic waste and disease surveillance since 2002. Over that time, we've done over 32,000 deer, and it's all voluntary. Hunter brings a deer into a registration station. We ask to take a sample. They agree to that. We give them a little patch as an incentive, and we've had tremendous cooperation from the Deer Hunters Association and other hunting groups, sportsmen's clubs, with incentives and importance of donating samples. So, you know, we've got a long road ahead of us with respect to getting landowner permission and then reducing densities, but it all hinges on hunter cooperation, and it's been good in the past, and I expect that to continue in the future.
Thank you. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cornicelli, do you know the age of the deer? Was the deer alive when that elk herd was there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, the age is not easy to determine because we don't have the head, but we do have notes on the sampling sheet, because everybody submits a sample, puts their information, that the biologist had written down this was a very old deer. And when I talked to the biologist, he said, the teeth were worn down past the gum line, which tells me it was probably at least 10 years old. When it was infected, you know, we can talk about the etiology of the disease, but it could have been infected 4 years ago, 2 years ago. We'll never know that. But it was an older animal, and that was noted, thankfully, on the sheet.
Any other questions, members?
I do.
I'm sorry. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cornicelli, I'm sorry I came in a little late, maybe you already covered this, but if I remember correctly, the chronic wasting disease that was found before was up in the north, kind of western part of the state. Now this is way in the southeastern part of the state. Do you think that those two cases are in any way related, or do we have Wisconsin to blame, or Iowa, or is there any way of ever knowing?
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's no definitive way to ever know because you can't strain type this disease agent. There have been four positive cases of CWD in Minnesota. They've all been in domestic elk and deer farms, one in Aitkin, one in Stearns County, a deer farm in southwest in Medicine, the Yellow Medicine County, and then one in Olmsted County, which is where we were doing surveillance. So, while we can't definitively say, obviously, if the deer didn't come from Wisconsin or some other place, we were doing it as part of our risk-based surveillance in association with an infection in a nearby area. But Mr. Bogus has something to add, I think.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I was just going to add that, you know, this is the first time we have found CWD in a wild deer in the state. The previous cases that Mr. Cornicelli referred to were all in captive cervids. But also, just for the committee's information, that this disease, how we respond to this disease can kind of go two directions. One is kind of the way Wisconsin ended up finding it. By the time they knew what they had a significant infection across a wide area. And if we were to be in that situation, there's really no way known to eliminate the disease at that point. It becomes more of a containment thing. The other potential scenario that we hope we're in, and we think based on all this surveillance that we've been doing since 2002, is more like a New York situation where they found one wild deer with CWD, and in the 4 years or so since that, they have not found any more positive deer. So we hope we have a very limited prevalence in a very small area, and in that scenario, we have a chance at least to contain or eliminate the disease. If it were found to be a significant infection across a broad area with CWD, there's really no known way to control it. You just try to contain it, keep it from spreading at that point. So that's why we're doing more surveillance this winter, is to try to figure out what exactly we're dealing with so that we can prepare a more detailed response.
Senator Higgins?
I have just one more question. What other types of animals are prone to or can possibly be infected by CWD? And these are the cervidae, right? But what else?
Correct. The disease is limited to cervids, which in our state are deer, elk, and moose. There's various agents that cover different species, but the one that's chronic wasting disease is specific to deer, elk, and moose only.
Okay. If there's no further questions, members, you do have a copy of some questions and answers in your packet, I think, from the Star Tribune. It might help you a little bit. But at this point, we'll let you go, and we'd certainly hope that you would keep us informed. I'm sure you will, and we'll have you come before the committee at a later date when you have a little more information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Next on the agenda, we're going to have an overview of the history of the Mississippi Corridor. We have testifiers DNR Steve Hirsch and Paul Labowitz. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name, we would appreciate that. And go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Hirsch. I'm the director of the Division of Ecological and Water Resources for the DNR. And what I thought I'd do today is just give a brief history of the Mississippi River Corridor critical area and summarize where we're at with the rulemaking process, if that'll fail. All right. So the corridor covers about a 72-mile stretch of the Mississippi River with Dayton and Ramsey to the north and then Hastings to the south. It includes about 30 local government units. And Minnesota passed the Critical Areas Act in 1973 in Chapter 116G, and then EQB then adopted rules to implement the act. And in 1976, Governor Wendell Anderson designated the Mississippi River and the adjacent corridor as a state critical area in Executive Order 130. And this executive order contains guidelines for how development occurs in the corridor, and these guidelines are administered and enforced by the LGUs along the river through local plans and ordinances. The designation was continued in an executive order in 1979 by Governor Quay, and then the Met Council acted that year to make the designation permanent. And then in 1988, the Mississippi National River and Recreational Area was established by Congress as a unit of the National Park Service, and Mr. Labowitz will elaborate on that in a few minutes. In 1991, then, this designated federal area became a state critical area by virtue of the statute that is being talked about today, 116G.15. And then in 1995, the responsibility for the critical area was shifted from EQB to DNR by Governor Carlson. And then in 2007, the legislature directed the DNR to prepare a report on the Mississippi River Corridor critical area, and we completed that report in January of 2008. And currently, all the LGUs in the corridor have a plan under the executive order, and all but three have an ordinance. And then in 2009, the legislature directed the DNR to develop new rules to replace the executive order and to start those rules by January 15th of 2010. And the mandate required that there be new districts created and minimum standards and guidelines, and it had very specific instructions in the rulemaking authority on the resources and features that had to be addressed in the rules. And this 2009 legislation arose out of general concern that the existing regulatory framework in the executive order had led to some inconsistency in how development had occurred and had not always protected key resources. So the DNR started the rulemaking process in December of 2009 by publishing the request for comments. We did go through an extensive public input process that went well beyond the requirements in both the Chapter 14 Administrative Procedures Act and the legislation, and I can provide those details if the members want. The draft rules would create 7 new districts to replace the existing 4 districts and incorporate a tiered approach. Areas away from the river, for example, would have fewer restrictions than areas closer to the river. And I think one key point here is that adoption of these rules would not change the overall regulatory framework of the critical area. That is, the LGUs would continue to administer and enforce their approved plans and ordinances under the proposed rules. In developing the proposed rules, as you all know, they became very controversial. And the most controversial elements were concerns about consistency of the draft rules with current land uses and comprehensive plans. Although the local ordinances already do include most of the requirements for setback and lot size and structure metrics, there was still a lot of concern that the new rules would create a lot of nonconformities in the corridor. And, you know, the DNR was certainly sensitive to that in developing the draft rules. We did not want to proliferate or create a bunch of new nonconformities with the rules, so we worked with the communities during the public input process to address that as much as possible. But the new rules, or the draft rules, I should say, would create some nonconformities. And the other thing on the other side of the equation was some of the environmental concerns were that there was some concerns with the bluff definition and the associated standards in the draft rules. So they were controversial from both angles. The DNR did try to balance the competing concerns related to development and protection in these draft rules, but we certainly do understand that there's been a lot of discussion about them, and not everybody agrees with the draft as we currently have that. But we do believe that the draft rules would provide some value in bringing consistency and clarity to the way that development occurs in the corridor and provide a better balance between economic development and natural resource protection. We are almost done with the completion of the draft rules, and we're currently in process of developing the SONAR, or Statement of Need and Reasonableness, which is a requirement when an agency does rules. However, it's likely that our authority to do these rules has already expired based on the provisions in Minnesota Statutes 14.125. We have not got an official ruling on that from the Office of Administrative Hearings, but our read of that statute indicates that our authority has likely expired because we didn't meet the 18-month deadline from the time we were authorized to do those rules. The deadline in there is that from the time you're authorized to do those rules, you have 18 months to notice those rules in the state register, and we did not meet that deadline. We would like to have the authority renewed because we think we've done some good work here and that we could add some value to the way that development occurs in the corridor and provide for a more consistent regulatory framework. So those are just sort of the highlights on the history and where we're at in the rulemaking process. And I can either stand for questions or have Mr. Labowitz.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, are we going to talk about this when the bill is heard or when?
Mr. Gazelka, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just some of the issues related to this. There's a bill coming up. Are we going to talk about it
then? The bill is going to be introduced after the next presenter, and then we can discuss what's in the bill. Mm-hmm. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I know that there were a lot of like competing interests that had a point of view that they presented during the rulemaking process, the local governments and others. Can you tell us a little bit during this rulemaking process how you tried to balance those competing interests and things that were, you know, squarely in conflict with each other?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, I can. And I should mention I also have Mr. Berg and Ms. Shilcox with me, who are the did a lot of the actual detail work on these rules, and they can help answer specific questions about the rules. But just to give a general idea on some of the issues we addressed, you know, we better address stormwater issues in these draft rules. We have more specific standards within the shore impact zone. We've got more targeted vegetation protection standards to key resource features. And so those are sort of interests that we tried to balance on the environmental side. But then we also have more flexible standards, we believe, in the draft rules to encourage recreational access to the river and more flexibility for facilities that need to be on the water, like commercial marinas or barge facilities and grain elevators and that sort of thing. So those are just some examples in there. There are some more, you know, I'm sure that we could address as well. So,
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, my question is that if these rules are adopted, what's the impact on the current property owners and or future development? Is there penalties already to be assessed for things that aren't done? Are they grandfathered in? Can you just expand on that?
Yeah, it's hard to generalize and all that. I mean, in general, as I mentioned earlier, we tried not to create a lot of new nonconformities with the rules. And so basically we looked at the executive order, we looked at existing development patterns on the river and you know, how those had occurred. And, you know, we tried to get into, you know, the statutory mandate required us to get into more detail than the executive order had. So, you know, we tried to look at existing development patterns and where, you know, for example, where there are already tall buildings. We don't want to create standards that say you can't have buildings that are taller than most of the buildings are already. And, you know, we tried to look at those sorts of things and develop a good, you know, kind of a good balance there. But, in general, if you have a nonconformity, you know, under the existing regulatory framework, you can't, you know, exacerbate or aggravate that nonconformity by adding to the footprint. So that type of activity, if it was going to exacerbate a nonconformity, would require a variance. But, you know, development that was within the guidelines that didn't aggravate nonconformities, additions to existing footprints could certainly continue as they do now.
Can I follow up?
Follow up, yes.
Yeah. So I guess you didn't answer the question about grandfathered in. Is there people in noncompliance that are going to be immediately penalized with this adoption of the rules, or how is that being handled?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kielash, no. The way it works is that, you know, the existing development doesn't all of a sudden become illegal and something has to be changed, but it's when you're going to change that existing footprint.
Thank you. Yeah.
Senator Saxlock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, fundamentally here, when we were talking about public input, does that mean that we had a lot of public hearings with the public? Does that mean that we saw a lot of city councils, county boards? What types of things did you do?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saxlock, I can elaborate on that. We established four geographically based work groups, and we held a total of 10 meetings throughout 2010. Those work groups represented a diversity of stakeholders, but they focused on business interests, landowner interests, environmental interests, and local and other government interests. We developed a rulemaking website and listserv so people could go online and get current status. We met with every local government unit, which was pretty substantial because there are 30 of them. And then we also had newsletters, and we conducted two open houses in the northern part of the corridor and the southern part of the corridor.
Follow-up.
Mr. Hirsch, particularly with those local units of government, did you have pretty good satisfied, do you think, with the input that they had? I mean, did you get a lot of pushback, or what was your impression of that?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saxlock, I think it was a mix. I think some of them were satisfied and saw that we were making some adjustments to the rules along the way to address some of the concerns they had with creating nonconformities. You know, others remained more concerned. So it was a mix.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Hirsch, the question I have is kind of relates specifically to try and help me clarify what effect we might be having on them. Right now in North Minneapolis, I'm picturing coming out of downtown, there's a large aggregate operation. I guess it would be on the west side of the river. Yeah, they bring aggregate up on barges regularly from down south and across the river on Marshall Avenue. There's a concrete block plant in that area. So you're saying those organizations, like those two operations, in order for them to expand, would have to get a variance from the city of Minneapolis?
Mr. Chairman, yes, and Senator Pedersen, I would have to know a little bit more about the nature of the expansion and how they fit. I'm not sure if Mr. Berg or Mr. Shilcox might be able to better answer that question.
Thank you. State your name and if you could answer that very quickly.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm Jeff Berg with Minnesota DNR. To the senator's question, we met with city staff, and that was the so specific questions like that. I can't answer specific site, but we had city staff tell us what their plan said, tell us what their local ordinances said, and what they felt our rules should address. So specifically to your specific site, I can't answer that.
Follow up. So did you talk about or are you familiar with the problem that cities would have right now in granting variances based on?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we met with every community, and I'd say the majority of communities, the issue of variances did come up as a substantial concern to communities.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along that same vein, though, I mean, if this rulemaking authority isn't extended, there's still statewide shoreland ordinances that would have to apply to this. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, within the Mississippi River Corridor, some communities do have shoreland ordinances. Some do not, and I don't know the history on why those that do and those that don't.
Mr. Hirsch?
Well, and I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, the other relevant point here is I don't think that the repeal of the rules would repeal the existing executive order that we're operating under, too. So I think that's relevant to bring up.
We'll continue with Mr. Lebowitz. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thanks for having me. My name is Paul Labovitz. I'm the superintendent for the National Park Service here at the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area. I'm also a citizen commissioner on the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and the geography I represent is from Elk River to Hastings, which is roughly the boundaries of our national park and roughly the boundaries of the state critical area. When folks ask me what my job is here, one, I'm hoping that I haven't surprised folks by mentioning that we have a national park about a mile from here on the Mississippi River. And when I'm asked what I do, I say I'm part of a great organization that takes care of America's natural and cultural treasures, and one of which is certainly the Mississippi River. Our national park here is 72 miles of the Mississippi. It's the only national park in a system of 394 units that is about the Mississippi River. So this is a pretty spectacular piece of the national park system. And we're really excited to be here in the upper Mississippi in Minnesota. When the park was established in 1988, it was determined that the Mississippi River had national significance. And arguably, the Mississippi River has global significance. We're looking at a river that drains over 40% of the continental United States. And to bring it home to folks about how important the Mississippi River is, no matter where I am in the country, I ask people, what's the first big word you learned how to spell? And you can hear the MISSISSIPPI. And when people come from all over the world to the United States and they come to the Midwest, one of the things they want to do is they want to see and touch the Mississippi River. It's really that terrific of a river resource. It's the third largest watershed on the globe. And for us, we're spoiled. It's just our local river, but it's pretty terrific. This national park was established in a very, it was a bit of an experiment for the national park system. It was established that we have a boundary, the same boundary as the state critical area, includes about 54,000 acres of land. The National Park Service owns 62 acres of those 54,000 acres. We are not a traditional national park insofar as we don't own the park, and we have no regulatory authority over the lands within the park beyond what we own in fee. And that was structured because at the time the park was established, the state of Minnesota made a promise to the nation in the national parks that the state would regulate the Mississippi River in the Mississippi River critical area. And so our comprehensive management plan sort of relies upon the promise made in Minnesota that the state and the local governments would regulate that critical area. And the National Park Service could focus its attentions on helping the local partners, and there are hundreds of them, but there are 25 units of government, helping those partners succeed in protecting, interpreting, and appropriately developing the river. We're not an anti-development organization here. The living, working river is part of our story. And so we've spent over 20 years in partnership with a countless number of partners, both municipal, state, federal agencies, and local nonprofits, and even individual landowners, to make sure that things that happen protect or enhance the Mississippi River and are not done with a negative impact to the river. It's a tall order. The river and the parks that we're an overlay over deliver recreation and cultural benefits to about 9 million visitors a year, which in national park numbers puts it in about the top five most visited national parks. Unfortunately for us, 90% of those people really don't know they've been to a national park because they're used to the Yellowstones and Yosemites. But the Mississippi River is bigger than the Yellowstone and Yosemites, and this is the way that river resource was structured to be protected. Some of the folks who were involved in that effort to create this national park are in the room today. And it's been a really tremendous example for the national park system about how to recognize one of America's great treasures in a very innovative way that sort of demonstrates a different and perhaps more appropriate role for the federal government to manage and interpret and protect challenging and complex landscapes. We were very excited with the updated rulemaking that started a couple years ago. After a couple of decades of some hit-and-miss enforcement of the critical area, we've seen increments of impact to the river, negative increments of impact, that over time really add up and start to, as you zoom back and look at the long-term health of the river, make you question, is what we tried to protect still there? Does it have integrity? And so the rulemaking was a really wonderful process that is enabled under Minnesota statute to sensibly and thoughtfully look at and let's update this critical area program to make it relevant not only now but into the future. And so the National Park Service is, we look at the potential dissolving of the critical area and the cancellation of rulemaking, which has really been a tremendous, arguably in a very short time frame, done some really wonderful work, and that we look at it as the most major threat to our national park. Because that the protection that we rely on to make sure that this park remains a nationally significant river resource, and we're at the top of the river, so what we do here really impacts our neighbors below us, we have to set the example. And quite frankly, what could happen if this repeal were to go through would be all that is our ability to really protect and appropriately develop the river and have the river become and maintain and stay as a vital piece of our economy, a great place to recreate, and a real protector of some of the best history and culture in the nation. That is all threatened. So that's my perspective. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that, Senator Kielash.
Yes. Mr. Lapovitz, your national park headquarters, are they located, or what kind of facilities are you supplying with this national park?
Our administrative headquarters are rented office space in Kellogg Square, just down the road here at Robert and Kellogg, and we have a visitor center in the lobby of the Science Museum of Minnesota.
Okay. And is there any expansion plans or any idea what you're going to do if this critical area remains?
Well, yeah, we continue on with a lot of program planning. We have a very large canoe program where we're trying to get 10,000 kids of the metro in canoes on the river. We're looking in a very preliminary way at the acquisition and redevelopment of the old Island Station power plant here in St. Paul, and perhaps to use that as a administrative headquarters and interpretive facility as well, and a place to access the river. We are doing a redevelopment plan in cooperation with Hennepin County, the Minnesota Historical Society, the Minnesota DNR, at the upper post at Fort Snelling, adjacent to the airport. We acquired a year ago 27 acres of land that was federally owned at the former Bureau of Mines headquarters, just downriver of Minnehaha Falls Park. Mm-hmm. And we're in the process of trying to demolish some old buildings on the site and restore it back to park and habitat. So we have a lot going on.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
And the critical – what makes this – my understanding is the fact that this is the Mississippi River Gorge helps make this special on the river itself.
Yes. The resource-based reason the national park is here is that the Mississippi River – depending on how you count miles, somewhere in the 2,300-mile, 2,500-mile length. In this 72-mile stretch of river, there are three very distinct forms of the river. Above the falls, up to the headwaters, is the Prairie River. The St. Anthony Falls and the gorge that the senator had mentioned is the only waterfall and gorge in the whole Mississippi River. As the river leaves the gorge and swings around through St. Paul, the river opens up to the Mississippi River that the entire world knows. And so that very interesting sort of geologic and river form is one of the reasons why the national park to represent the river was selected to be located here.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Labowitz, many of the things that the U.S. Forest Service has done with regard to this park was started prior to the statute that talked about the rulemaking. Is that correct?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
The plans that you have for enhancing the federal park system were enacted and put into place and were planned prior to the 2009 rulemaking process. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. The park was established after the state critical area was established. And as I mentioned, the Congress established this national park in 1988.
Correct. Thank you.
Question, Mr. Superintendent, that I have is you commented, and first of all, it's a tremendous thing to have a national park in Minnesota, and I think all Minnesotans certainly appreciate the fact that we do have that here, and it is a tremendous resource to visit. Unfortunately, like you say, it isn't very well advertised, so they even ask you what you're doing here when you come to the meeting. That's a little troublesome, but nevertheless. We certainly appreciate what you're doing. The question that I have is, are you participating or have you participated with the DNR during this last 18-month study? And another comment that you had made during your presentation was the hit and misses of enforcement that have been going on in the past. Can you tell me about any of those hits and misses?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's the Park Service has been a very active partner throughout the rulemaking process. So we're very invested to help the state figure out what's best for the Mississippi River critical area. The hits and misses are the kind of things that when you have local enforcement and state oversight based on the ability of a municipality or even the interest to create ordinances and then enforce those ordinances, In the era of it's tough to do a good job in government because capacities and resources are slim, when 20 and 30 years go by, a variance here, a development here that didn't go through the proper discussion and planning process, in the accumulation of that kind of activity, you all of a sudden, as you zoom out and look, you see that it's the death of a thousand cuts. And so there's a responsibility of communities along rivers. And it's sort of it's a tough thing for folks to get their heads around, insofar as the Mississippi River is such a big place, and so the there's an old saying that we all live downstream. Everything we do here has an impact to the person who's below us, and in our case, the folks who are below us are the Gulf of Mexico, and so I tell people that the things that we do in Minnesota. Or the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that folks may be familiar with, it starts right here in Minnesota. And so we have a responsibility, not as just Minnesotans living along and along the river, but we have a responsibility to all the folks along the river and in the watershed to take care of it. And I think we've done a good job, for the most part, demonstrating that. But when we start to pull back with programs like this that are designed to really let us be thoughtful for the long run about what's good for the river, that puts our position at the top of that game in jeopardy.
Okay, thank you for that. I guess maybe it would be fair for me to say then that it is your past experience here since being here. You have not seen any local units of government that would have violated any land resource or any shoreline rules at all? Have you had any specifics that you can come to? I know we don't want that. I mean, I think everybody in the room agrees to that. We don't want any of that.
Well, I could take you to places along the river, and I could identify, without knowing how the developments or the improvements, quote-unquote, got there, that were probably in violation of the state critical area program. And the example I would give you is if you're on the Mississippi River and you're coming out of the gorge and you're coming to the confluence of the Minnesota-Mississippi River, and you look to the right up on top of the bank, is that Mendota Heights? And there's a series of condos and apartments that are built right on the edge of the bluff. And I would venture to say that that's the kind of development the Mississippi River Critical Area Program, would, had it been consulted and enforced, would not have allowed. And it's sort of ironic that about a year ago, as all these issues were bubbling up about critical areas, there was a piece in one of the local papers about some of those buildings were in jeopardy of crumbling and falling over the side, and there was a plea for some assistance to help correct the problem. And we already had in place the state critical area program, which would have corrected the problem, which would have prevented the development there. But due to a variety of issues about the ability to enforce these regulations, it happened. And so those are the kind of things that's one place. You can go up and down the river in many places and see a lot of that kind of incremental development that either nudged against or really overwhelmed what the critical area would have allowed to happen to keep the river looking and being healthy. So, you know, if we could supply a list of that, I'd be happy to follow up with that information.
Thank you. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, would it be correct to say that it wouldn't necessarily have prevented the development totally, but would have required a setback?
Correct.
For example, so you're not on the sensitive bluffs that are subject to erosion. And then, you know, if people, like in California during the mudslides, if people's houses are sliding down the hill, then they want government to come in and rescue them. And, you know, that costs all of us more.
Thanks,
Chair.
Those.
Senator Pappas, I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you.
Thanks for those comments, Senator. And I think we're going to be hearing from some of the folks here, both pro and con, with regards to those regulations, whether we actually have been allowing violations here in Minnesota or not. So I think we can get into that. I'm sorry, Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Trying to figure out which question I want to ask. Maybe it's this one. What's the practical effect of the of this bill to take away the rulemaking authority and to basically take away all but about the first paragraph of the existing law? How will that change how you work?
I guess would either the presenters like to answer that question, or would you sooner have the author of the bill to answer that question?
In the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I you know, either way, Steve, do you have a thought?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, I think the bill is pretty clearly just takes away our rulemaking authority very explicitly, and then basically makes null and void all the work we've done on the draft rules up till now, at least the way I read it.
But, Mr. Chair?
Follow.
And Mr. Hirsch, it also looks like it repeals subdivisions 2 through 7, which is basically everything except subdivision 1. So I think it's a little bit more than that.
Technicability amendment.
Well,
that's all I'm making.
Okay. I'm sorry, Senator Scoy.
Well, just to follow along on that, if this bill moves forward, what I don't understand is why the state shoreland ordinance doesn't kick in, because, you know, when I was on the county board in northern Minnesota, if anybody wanted to do development on a river that was in our county, they had to come and get a permit, and there were limits to what was allowed to do, and there were restrictions. Why doesn't that same 1,000-foot next to the river apply in this area that it does in the area that where I live?
Mr. Hurst, real quickly, then we'll move into the author here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scori, a couple of things. I think, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, the executive order would still be in place, which does still address some of the way that development occurs. The other thing that I do know, I'm not an expert on the shoreland rules, but I know that in the shoreland rules, shoreland is defined as being, I believe it is 300 feet either side of the river's edge or the landward side of a delineated floodplain. And so this corridor is wider than that. I don't know if that's a complete answer, but those are just a couple of points I'd make. So.
Okay, thank you.
That helps.
Nothing further, we'll move on. Thank you very much for the testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Cruz. Members, we're going to be hearing Senate File 39. Senator Cruz will be introducing that. Do you have any folks that you would wish to have come up with you, share a chair at the table?
We do have a list here. I guess I would just start with Ms. Corkle, the first person on the list, okay. And have them come up.
Senator Cruz, first, before that, we do have an A1 amendment to get your bill in order. Senator Dames?
Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
Does everybody have a copy of that? An author's amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Dames.
I move the amendment.
Senator Dames has moved the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Okay. Senator Cruz, your bill is in order.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today. This bill is a very near and dear bill to my heart. One of the first things that I encountered as I was running for office this last session was residents of mine from all spectrums approached me about this bill and the concerns that they have. I think today as we go through these testifiers, you're going to hear a story. You're going to hear a story of property values. You're going to hear a story told from multiple sources, stories from municipalities. You're going to hear stories from residents. You're going to hear stories from businesses. You're going to hear stories from county officials. This is something that, you know, has mentioned. It's been in the works for a long time. I know that we have a lot of folks here who'd like to testify, so I want to make sure to leave room for that. Before we step into it, I would just like to say that the goal of this, and thank you for offering that amendment, Senator Dames, is to strictly repeal the rulemaking authority. That is the concern we have here. There's a concern there for a couple of different reasons. The first concern being that it is redundant, that we do already have shoreline rules. We already have an executive order in place that has done a great job of managing the corridor and protecting our beautiful national park. I think that you also have a concern of, like I mentioned, property values. That's a huge impact that it has had to our residents. A lot of folks who have retirement money tied up in their homes. A lot of folks that purchased property along the Mississippi River that were counting on that. And now they in real estate, I'm an old real estate guy. And in real estate, we have a term called useful enjoyment. Now, what useful enjoyment is anytime you purchase a property and you're doing disclosure documents, you have to disclose anything that may inhibit the useful enjoyment of a property. Now, we do that here in Minnesota for a very specific reason. We want to make sure that folks know what they're purchasing. Real estate, be it on a commercial level or a residential level, is a huge investment. And I think that it's important here in Minnesota that we protect that investment. I think that the folks who live and operate businesses along our Mississippi River care more about that river than anybody else because of that investment. So with that, I'd like to let Ms. Corkle speak.
Welcome to the committee and members. If I could, other testifiers, we'd like to limit our time to as quickly as you possibly can and hold those questions until we get through the folks that are in support, and then we'll open that up for questions if that's okay. So just jot down your questions if you have any. And we'll start with Anoka County Commissioner Jackie Corkle. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Jacqueline Corkle, and I go by the name Jack. So,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, just in case there's any confusion. I am actually not a commissioner. I am the senior multimodal transportation planner for the county and have been on the Northwest Working Group as part of the process. And I'm here today to support our county board position of repealing the existing legislation. And there's four primary reasons why our commissioners are concerned about the current legislation and would like to see it be repealed. And the first part was the public involvement process. The second concern is the ability of the local communities to enact and adopt local land use and their zoning authority. The third concern is consistency throughout the corridor to treat equal types of properties the same. And then the fourth and one of the more important reasons is the rights of the property owners, both residential and commercial interests along the corridor. In order to get back to the public involvement process, as many folks here have already indicated, it's a 72-mile-long corridor, and there are literally thousands of property owners along this corridor that have a vested interest in what happens not only to their property but to the properties around them. And unfortunately, as also pointed out earlier, a lot of these property owners don't realize that they're even in this critical corridor area or that the potential rulemaking has an effect on them. And that is one of the county's main concerns, is that the property owners in this area were not notified and they did not have access to the process or to be able to provide input. In August of last year, the attorneys for both Hennepin and Anoka County wrote a letter to the DNR expressing their concern about the public involvement process and the lack of engagement of individual property owners. The DNR did an excellent job in terms of engaging the communities, meaning staff, along the corridor, but not necessarily the individual property owners. The information on the website was very useful, again, if you knew it was there and that the process was going on. And I would say that the biggest concern was that people did not know that process was going on. Another concern of the board was that, you know, comments were definitely received by the DNR as the process was going along. We had four different work group meetings where folks could express their opinion on the proposed standards as well as the proposed land uses. And the information was collected, but it wasn't necessarily explained how it was going to be used or why something wasn't used. And so there were times where comments were incorporated, which was definitely appreciated, but there were times where the comments were not, and there wasn't an understanding as to why it was not incorporated into the process. And we realize that there are many competing interests, agendas, and even personalities that have been involved in this process, and it's difficult to balance all of those individuals, especially in a process that is about a year long. So there were time constraints and other issues that hampered the ability of the DNR to work through some of those issues. In terms of local land use and zoning authority, presently the local communities do have that authority on the corridor. And the concern is with the new standards that are being suggested that the locals really do lose their own flexibility in adopting the rules that they think are important in protecting the corridor. Along with that, as mentioned previously by some of the senators here in this room, is the concern about the variance law, where right now, basically, communities cannot grant variances. Now, I realize you're working towards changing that, we all hope, but for right now, it's a concern because there isn't that flexibility to make modifications or to correct situations where maybe the round peg doesn't fit in the square hole. Additionally, some of the proposed standards do create some conflicts with existing ordinances, which the legislation directed the DNR to take into consideration. And an example of that is the local comprehensive plans. The communities in the metropolitan area are required to do these comprehensive plans where they plan for their future growth. And as part of that, they have certain density requirements, population, housing, jobs that they need to meet targets for. And in some cases, the communities have set their targets. It's been approved by the Metropolitan Council, but the proposed standards would take that density down. and it would not be in conformance then with their comprehensive plan. So then you have two agencies that are telling you how to regulate some of your land use, and they're in direct conflict with one another. Another concern from a selfish perspective, as a Highway County employee and as somebody who works with our Parks Department, is that we own a large number of parcels along the corridor, and we manage parks. And one of the concerns is that parks aren't treated equally throughout the area. So in some areas, park buildings, you know, can be 60, 65 feet tall. In other areas, building height is limited to 25 feet. In some areas where vegetation has been cleared, it's easy to put up public outlooks or picnic shelters that would have views of the river. In other areas, there's vegetation screening requirements that would make putting up some of those new facilities difficult to share that watershed view, or the reason why we're bringing folks to our parks in the first place. So our concern is really of treating the parks equally across the board. Related to that is the master park planning process. And during that process, areas that have been identified as regional parks by the Metropolitan Council, as well as the communities in which they're located, are required to go through a rather extensive process to look at resources in the park and to determine what facilities are appropriate for that park. As part of that process, there's a number of public meetings, as well as review by the DNR, the Met Council, and in the critical corridor area, the National Park Service. So we believe that these areas that are designated as regional parks already go through a rather extensive process, and to add another set of rules on top of that that may limit ability to get people to the park and to the river is a concern for us as well. Finally, I'll try to be quick here, and others will speak to this more eloquently than I can. It's the rights of the property owners that is a concern, both for businesses and residential units. Again, a lot of this comes back to the current variances with the Supreme Court ruling and the ability of property owners to develop and redevelop their property. You know, if somebody wants to add on a deck and it's outside of the area where they can, you know, that's not allowed. And so that's a concern. Our residents have brought that issue up to the board, as well as our business owners. And again, I will let others speak to that effect. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next on the agenda is the mayor of Champlin, Mark Uglum.
Yes.
Thank you. Then welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, my name is Mark Uglum. It's Norwegian, but don't hold that against me.
That's something we have in common.
Yeah. Jack, you want a job in Champlin? You did a great job there. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 39. And I guess really what I have to tell you is you just saw a perfect example of a planner, a local planner, that is very concerned about the river and explained quite eloquently about what we do in terms of cities and other locals of local units of government. We have professional planners on staff, and we are obviously very, very concerned about the river and the development. I have the greatest respect for the DNR and the National Park Service. But on the other hand, these proposed rulemaking points definitely tie our hands. And I honestly don't think we're doing a bad job with the river today. In Champlin, for example, every single time that we have a development going on along the river, whether it be a house or a lot split or whatever, we consult with the DNR right now, you know, face-to-face, our city planner and their people. We have never, never, ever had a problem with what we've wanted to do. You know, we have a comprehensive growth plan. We have zoning. We have setbacks. These things are all there now. And the way that the bill reads, going back to, you know, the rulemaking being the executive order, Governor Quay's executive order, I'm sorry, but I think that works. Now, there's always need for some fine-tuning and everything else. But the bottom line is, we have an urban river. We have a river that's suburban in Champlin and in Anoka and Coon Rapids and all that. It's not going to be the Upper St. Croix. It's not going to be what we think a national park is. I'm a big sportsman. I hunt, I fish, and I go to the boundary waters and everything else. And I'm all for anything that we can do to make the Mississippi River better for the recreation of our residents. But I also am totally against loss of local control. I think that local elected officials, rather than bureaucrats, are the people that should be responsible. And I'm not saying bureaucrats are bad by any means, but local officials are. Local officials are held accountable every election cycle. I mean, don't we know it, right? And that's the way it should be. It really should. And our property owners along the river in Champlain, and I can speak for the people in Champlain, are very concerned that the river stay nice, stay clean. But at the same time, they're also concerned that they need to use the river. We have the recreational pool that backs up behind the Coon Rapids Dam in Champlain and Brooklyn Park and Coon Rapids and Anoka. Every weekend, you know, people are out there on their pontoon boats enjoying things. Kids are water skiing. People are fishing. And they're using the river. And it's not going to be, you know, too many canoers out there. I'm sorry, because they're going to get run over by the boats. But that's the way it is. And I think we ought to be able to use the river. I think that we have to be good stewards of the river. And I think we're doing that right now. The other thing about the proposed rules is it ties our hands. There are, just for example, if we decide that some developer comes to the city of Champlain and we need maybe a slight variance to the rules, our city planner and department, I brought Scott with us today, I mean, it could take us, you know, another person on our staff to work through all of these rulemakings for any type of meaningful development in the city. And we have, in our comprehensive growth plan, some big plans for the river. And those plans are for the people of Champlain and the people of the surrounding areas, so they can use the river, so they can recreate on the river, and they can have a lot of fun on the river. These proposed rule changes, minor changes would become major projects for us. Vegetative management, we do already. When we just had an individual that had an old, you know, retaining wall that was falling down, and he wanted to replace it with some nice rocks, and we required, of course, screening and all of that, and we did talk to our counterparts at the DNR about that. The other thing about, and Jack alluded to this, the district boundary changes and things, it's unrealistic to just draw a line here and say this is going to be this way and this is going to be that way. It would be very, very difficult to do that way. So really, this thing can kill some jobs, kill some development. The current system is working well. And I, for one, look at it and say, let the local units of government, let the local professional planners at the city and county level work with the DNR like they're working with them today. And we're all good stewards of the river. We all want to work to make the river better. But don't force us to do it. Don't give us a whole bunch of rules that we have to hire extra people to enforce and work through. And let's just try to cooperate the way we have been cooperating in the past. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move forward to the next testifiers. They're both from Twin West Chamber, both Lori Higgins and Richard. Really having some names today, I'm sorry. I'll let you identify yourself, Richard.
Hello,
if you'd please come forward and identify yourself, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Lori Higgins. I'm the president of the Metro North Chamber, actually. So I represent about 650 businesses in the Anoka County area.
And I'm Richard Halupsak. I've been on the board of the Metro North Chamber of Commerce for 6 years.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The reason why we're here today is because part of our mission is to advocate for the businesses that we represent, and we take that very seriously. We're here today because on January 12th of 2011, our 15-member board passed a resolution unanimously supporting the repeal of the authority of the DNR to do the rulemaking on the Mississippi River Critical Corridor area. And I do have a copy of that should you like to have that for your records. The reason why this came before our board of directors is because our government affairs committee researched this issue quite in depth over the last few months, and Dick was a part of that research. We heard from many stakeholders, from chamber members to elected officials on both sides of the aisle, to cities, to the county, and there were a multitude of concerns about this process, everything from potential negative impact to economic development, to local control issues, to property values, and also the communication process that was taken. Senator Cruz talked about sharing stories, and for us, this was very deja vu-like for a process that we went through a few years ago where communication was a chief component of that story. I'm going to let Richard share a little bit about that.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I worked on Highway 65 in the city of Blaine for a few years when upgrades and proposals were made to change Highway 65. And as Jack Corkle mentioned earlier, it is our understanding that not all of the property owners along the 72-mile corridor of the Mississippi River have been informed about the rulemaking process. And I'm imagining that some of them don't know they're even in this critical area, let alone that there are going to be impacts on them. When we started working on Highway 65, we found that it was absolutely imperative to talk to absolutely every property owner and people that are affected on and near the corridor. We found at the beginning that there were many misunderstandings regarding the information that was proposed related to the Highway 65 changes. Mr. Labovitz has told us all that there's 54,000 acres in this park. I can imagine that that would encompass many, many property owners. He also mentioned that many visitors to the park don't know they've even been in a park. This is exactly what I'm talking about. The information is absolutely critical. I think that we need to contact all of the property owners that are involved and impacted and make sure that everyone is aware of what is happening. On Highway 65, we didn't make everybody happy. We made everybody informed. Thank you.
And the last thing that I would like to say, Mr. Chair and committee members, we've all mentioned that we are all aware this is a wonderful resource, and we certainly believe that as well. On a personal note, I grew up within walking distance of the Coon Rapids Dam. I attended Mississippi Elementary School. I can spell that in my sleep and backwards 8 ways from Sunday. But we just want to be sure that everybody's on the same page, that everybody is informed. Last fall, I talked with a former colleague of yours who said to me, "I'm about as green as you can get, but this is just bad policy." And so I just wanted to leave you with that note, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much to the two of you. We'll move on to, as we see, you can see, we still got quite a list here. So Eric Myers from, is he here? Eric Myers?
Yeah.
Mr. Myers, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
State your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Eric Myers, North Metro Realtors Association, represent 1,600 realtors in the North Metro area. Our home office is primarily based out of Coon Rapids. Also with me today is John Perriard from the St. Paul Association of Realtors, representing another in total 6,000 realtors in the metro area. We became aware of this issue as it started to move last year throughout the better part of 2010, and the rules were. The DNR was taking these rules down the path. There's a long history with this legislation and the executive orders that are on each other from over and over. But we took and piled up all the information at the time, more than 50 pages worth of information that actually was posted on the DNR website or in the rules or in state legislation. And we shipped it off to the National Association of Realtors and went after some expertise in land use policy. So we submitted that in September, received it by the end of September, and we received a 15-page analysis from their land use initiative. From that document, we were able to create a 3-page document focusing on our concerns for the Mississippi River Critical Corridor area. I have that copies here as well of our comments that were provided to the DNR on November 5th of 2010. And really, it just five main areas that we have concerns in: existing the impacts on existing property owners. Many of them will be, we believe, will be forced into non-conforming status. Certainly, their use and enjoyment will be affected on the for their property. Should they have to, it was mentioned previously that if you have to rebuild a deck, or if you have a dock now or don't have a dock now and you plan to have a dock later, or even just access to the river itself. So we were really concerned about the existing property owners. We were also concerned about the potential stifling of new development, particularly in our area from Coon Rapids all the way up. Coon Rapids is a mostly developed city, but as you go west of us, there's still a lot of development to be done, and there's still a portion of that corridor that still needs development. The city of Ramsey and others are still looking for rapid development, even in today's economy. I just met with those folks last week. They're redeveloping their core area, their downtown area, and they'll be looking at the river as well. So we were really concerned about the impacts of these standards on new development. But the real large concern is kind of a twofold problem with variances and nonconformities. So our nonconformity problem would be that these rules come in place at a time when the variance standard has just been raised as a result of the Supreme Court case with Krommenacker. And someone mentioned earlier that I think it was Jack that it's actually going to hopefully be changed this session. We hope that's a change that could occur. But in the meantime, we're really hoping that our homeowners and potential homeowners in the future don't find themselves in a position where they can't use their property or replace their property or expand their footprint beyond this, and that they would have to go to the city to get a variance, as it would be now without the change to Krommenacker from the Krommenacker decision. That variance threshold is even higher. So a property owner can find themselves nonconforming and then have to go get a variance. The city might be in a position not even be able to grant that variance. So that's a major concern for us. Beyond that, we think these rules went way too far in land use and private property rights. There's a whole section on that, and they just fall short in those areas. There's quite a bit of duplication with multiple agencies. You've got the PCA, you've got the DNR, local watersheds, and a whole range of groups that are looking at the river and that are charged with protecting the river and the resource itself. So we think this is, and plus the cities are already doing this work. You've heard that earlier from other cities. So we just think this is duplicative. And there are also some concerns in there with very specific definitions. So those are the areas of concerns that we have as realtors. Our agents live and work in this area. One of our most active realtors couldn't be here today. Lived in Coon Rapids his whole life. He lives on the river now, sells homes in the area, and this was very, very concerning to them. So they asked me to be here today and share these five concerns with you. So,
thank you, Mr. Myers. If you could just keep yourself available for questions when we get done, we'd appreciate that. We'll move on to Mr. Stutrud, please. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Mark Stutrud, another Norwegian, I'm afraid. I'm the founder and president of Summit Brewing Company, located in St. Paul, right here in Crosby Lake Business Park. I'm also a resident of St. Paul, have been for 29 years, and I think after growing up in North Dakota, I've been finally assimilated in this city. I really want to thank you for listening to my testimony. I've been actively involved in this issue since 2006, when I was informed that I should show up to hear some recommendations of a task force that the City of St. Paul had put together. And at that particular meeting, I was informed that the recommendations to protect the Mississippi River critical area was to rezone certain parts of a business park that I'm currently located in. And this rezoning aspect, as most of you know, would make the business, the brewery, and the structure nonconforming. Now, I've been called a nonconformist in the past, and so I needed to ask for some clarity. And I was basically told at that meeting that I would never be able to secure a building permit to expand. And this is exactly why we built a facility from the ground up in 1997, moved in 1998. We've been at our current location for 13 years. We've more than doubled our employment in that time. And we have an expansion area that's been there by design since our very first building permit. So I was in shock, to be honest, and I've been keeping very close tabs of this issue. The brewery is a very green business. For any business person today, we have to be stewards of the environment. Water conservation, energy conservation is huge. It's a huge cost for us in the brewery. And to give you an idea of the kind of progress we've just made in the past years, that our production has grown 10% from 2009 to 2010, but our utility costs have flattened out. We're also very aware of all of the zoning requirements to protect the river, because we are very close to a bluff that puts us in question. One of the experiences that I've had that really troubles me is that it's very important that regulatory agencies do not change the rules in midstream on businesses. We have over $24 million invested in our brewery, and to be faced with being nonconforming is a huge issue. Crosby Lake Business Park is also a very unique development. The brewery sits on the former site of the Texaco Tank Farm. I remember moving to St. Paul in 1981 and looking at Shepherd Road and the scrapyards and the remnants of American Hoist and Derrick. And there have been marvelous changes, and a lot of progress has occurred along the Mississippi River Gorge during the time that I've lived here. So I think it's very important, first of all, to recognize the progress that has been made. Secondly, it's very important for the community to really recognize the hard investment that companies put into their businesses. So the process has to be transparent and accountable. I'm an advocate of having the local government agencies and units be involved in this process. We have a process currently that works today. There has been some misinformation floating about what is in the executive order and what isn't, and height restrictions are a specific example of that. I have received complaints about the height of our current facility and concerns that I may add on to our facility at the same height. But I assure you, through my relationship with the City of St. Paul, that all zoning requirements were met and that we were in total compliance with our structure. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Tideken and then Roger Cruz. If I could just ask your indulgence to limit your comments with regards to we've already had pretty good testimony as to why we think this bill should move forward, but if you can shorten that up, great, that'd be fine. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, my name is Nick Tiedekin, and I've been living on the riverfront in Brooklyn Park for over 20 years now. I also represent a small local group called River Community Coalition, and we formed in about 1998. In response to the update to the Brooklyn Park Stewardship Plan, Mississippi River Stewardship Plan, and the ordinances that were being pushed by the DNR and the National Park Service after the MNRA plan came out. So we've been involved in this for quite a few years. Our group has also been involved in testifying against the rulemaking authority in 2009. We had many concerns there. We asked the question repeatedly, what is broken? We've never heard what is broken. We have existing plans and ordinances in place that the cities are implementing. In the time since the last update in 98, we've had houses built in our community on the river. On the banks of the river, excuse me. We've had people add decks. We've had retaining walls put in. And in my estimation, there has been no measurable adverse effect on the river from any of that. One of the fears that we had in our testimony in 2009 was the notion of the green tunnel, where when you go down the Mississippi River, the goal was to, all you could see was green all around you. And we were assured that that was a fear that was not going to happen. Well, as the rule process developed here, and I've been a stakeholder on that, on the rules committee, we have seen language introduced that talked about restoring areas to a wild state and having to record that on a conservation easement. We've had seen language talking about restoring areas to, again, a natural state, things that are very city labor intensive, such as if we were going to control invasive species, or I think the term is invasive non-native species, we would have to obtain permission from the city before we could actually control them. And this seems to be going quite a bit too far having people regulating what goes on in your backyard. And so we're very concerned about the extent that the rules are going. And that's just one example, and I talk about nonconformities and that, but that's already been covered. So the process itself has been quite divisive. It's pitted good people against good people on both sides. We both have good ideas, but we don't see what's broken. The rules are as drafted. Well, actually, they're in a different stage now than they were at the last I saw, but they're very complex, they're very prescriptive, and I would estimate that they have questionable value as to actually adding additional protection or having some measurable improvement in the quality of the river. Like I said, we've had houses built in our area, and the river's still flowing. We also believe that the effect of these restrictions, again, this green tunnel philosophy that's out there, will have a negative effect on our land, our property, our ability to manage our property in a rational and reasonable way. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, Roger Cruz. Mr. Cruz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Roger Cruz. And I never dreamed I would be involved in a process like this, so I apologize in advance if I don't meet all of the protocol of a meeting like this. I was first introduced to this process by a knock on the door to my house by a work group member, Steve Schmidt, who was representing the citizens from the area of Anoka who felt, since nobody knew, he was trying to get the word out. He invited me to attend a work group meeting, which was held in June, at the end of June in Brooklyn Park, where I sat on the sideline, was not allowed to participate in any way, and listened to things being spoken about what can and cannot be done with my property, as well as some very disparaging remarks about if the people on the committee didn't like it, they might tear down my dam. I took great offense to that. I was very concerned, and on that day, for the first day, I met Grady Kinghorn. We met in the lobby for a few minutes, spoke, and that evening we spoke, and we decided that things were so pitted against the homeowners that we took the action of hiring a law firm, Gray Plant Moody, to represent the interests of the homeowners. After we organized and had the group meet the attorney, and he reviewed the circumstances, he felt that the actions of the DNR and the process that were going on were so egregious, they didn't even believe that it could pass administrative law making, which at that point I didn't even know what that meant. I've spent an awful lot of time reading law about this. I've spent an awful lot of time talking to people up and down the river, cities, counties. I think we started with 30 people in my home, which grew to several hundred up and down the river. I personally have mailed out tens of thousands of documents. I was told by people at the DNR they have no way to know how many people would be affected or who lives on the river. Well, Roger Cruz contacted the GIS, and I was able to buy the mailing list. So I was a little offended by I questioned the genuineness of the people in charge of this process from early on, and if they really were interested in a process that was fair and open, or if they were simply interested in railroading a bunch of rules down our throats without us even being informed. Well, we've informed an awful lot of people. Yes, the St. Paul paper called me the most vociferous one of the metropolitan area. And yes, I think we were very right in bringing this to the table. Prior to our involvement, there were no public meetings scheduled. The only meetings were the work group meetings, of which we were specifically told and asked not to come to. When we came to St. Paul on a Thursday with over 100 people for one of those sessions, they asked us to leave because they thought there was too many of us. We did not. I do think if you really investigate this, like Nick was saying, we asked the question, what are we really trying to accomplish? We were deemed as the people against the clean environment. I live on the water. I use the water. My children use the water. I have a grandchild. We use the water all the time. The river has never been cleaner. It's getting cleaner without the help of this process that's being conducted. And again, if it is indeed going to be better, we simply ask, show us some science as to how the processes that are being recommended will indeed improve the Mississippi River. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes the testimony for the folks that are in favor of the bill. Are there any questions of the committee before we move on to the rest of the testifiers? Okay, with that, we'll start out with Whitney Clark. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Whitney Clark. I'm the executive director of Friends of the Mississippi River. We are a St. Paul-based nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and enhancing the Mississippi River and its watershed in the Twin Cities area. I'm here today representing Friends of the Mississippi River's 1,700 members, more than 3,000 annual volunteers, and hundreds of event participants who see the Mississippi River as both a natural resource of international significance and a local treasure. In your packets, you should have a letter from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership urging your opposition to Senate File 39. It's signed on to by 36 Minnesota organizations. As has been noted, the Mississippi River Critical Area has been designated by Congress as a national park. It's become an outstanding fishery, especially smallmouth bass. It's a recreational destination for millions of visitors every year and a magnet for bird watchers who flock to the river every spring and fall to watch the migration of millions of songbirds and more than 40% of North America's waterfowl that use the Mississippi River Flyway. The river is also the source of drinking water for hundreds of thousands of Twin Cities residents and more than 20 million Americans downstream. Friends of the Mississippi River was actively engaged in helping to pass the 2009 amendments to 116G that Senate File 39 would now repeal. As a reminder, the 2009 amendments were the result of many years of discussions among river stakeholders about how to best protect the great shared asset of the river. And those amendments in 2009 passed with bipartisan support and a $500,000 appropriation, which was signed by Governor Pawlenty. Before voting to repeal the statute, I guess I would ask members to draw their attention to the law in question. Subdivision 2, and I won't go over the whole thing. Obviously, you can do that, but I just wanted to share a couple of parts that seem significant. Subdivision 2 states, the commissioner shall ensure that the Mississippi River Corridor critical area is managed as a multi-purpose resource in a way that conserves the scenic, environmental, recreational, mineral, economic, cultural, and historic resources and functions of the river corridor. that maintains the river channel for transportation by providing and maintaining barging and fleeting areas in appropriate locations consistent with the character of the Mississippi River and riverfront, that provides for the continuation and development of a variety of urban uses, including industrial and commercial uses and residential uses, where appropriate within the Mississippi River corridor, that utilizes certain reaches of the river as a source of water supply and as a receiving water for properly treated sewage from stormwater and industrial waste effluents, and that protects and preserves the biological and ecological functions of the corridor. Subdivision 2, Section 5, Subpart C goes on to provide that the rules must be consistent with residential nonconformity provisions under Sections 394.36 and 462.357. These were added as amendments when these concerns about nonconformities came up in the many hearings that we had during the 2009 session. These are existing Minnesota statutes that protect property owners and provide for the continuation of nonconformities. Subdivision 4 provides some guidelines for what the rules need to do. It says the guidelines and standards must protect or enhance the following key resources and features: floodplains, wetlands, gorges, areas of confluence with key tributaries, natural drainage routes, shorelines and riverbanks, bluffs, steep slopes and very steep slopes, unstable soils and bedrock, significant existing vegetative stands, tree canopies and native plant communities, scenic views and vistas, publicly owned parks, trails and open spaces, cultural and historic sites and structures, and water quality. Why, I would ask you, would this law need to be repealed? Clearly, 116G.15 recognizes the river as a multi-use resource. It does not, in fact, seek to create a wilderness right here in the heart of the Twin Cities. To the contrary, the Mississippi River Corridor critical area was established because it is an urban area, and as such, it's subject to many conflicting uses and has many stakeholders. The legislation provides for rulemaking so that there can be basic, common-sense rules that provide for consistency throughout the corridor. If members or citizens of in the public have objections to specific preliminary draft standards that have been proposed but have not yet been finalized, we believe that those concerns are best addressed through the rigorous rulemaking process and judicial review, which requires that the DNR provide evidence that each new rule is both needed and reasonable. And this process is, of course, subject to public comment. It's subject to expert testimony and the submission of other evidence to ensure that the rules don't overreach. I've heard a lot of statements today. Some of them, I think, repeat mischaracterizations, and I'd like to just try to clarify for the record a couple of those. First of all, updated rules for the critical area will not change local land use control. Local government units will remain the vehicle by which land use, zoning, and discretionary actions will be decided, and the authority of the DNR under the new rules will remain exactly the same as they have been for 30 years. The new rules will allow for nonconforming uses, as has been mentioned, and structures to continue in the corridor according to Minnesota state law. No changes will be required of existing nonconformities. It's when you attempt to add or exacerbate a nonconformity that there would be issues. So it's not that you couldn't add a deck. It would be you couldn't add a deck if adding that deck adds to the nonconformity. And the new rules allow for hydropower and other river-dependent utilities and uses. The Mississippi River Corridor, Critical Area Corridor, is a resource of regional, statewide, national, and even international significance that requires special management to retain its health and vitality. The Mississippi River is a drinking water source for more than 20 million Americans, and unfortunately, in our stretch, the Twin Cities here, every mile of the river through the Twin Cities is impaired. It does not meet the state standards for water quality. New standards, we believe, are very much needed to reduce runoff pollution to the river. With 30 local units of government and land use authority along the river, We strongly believe that some overarching guidelines are necessary to avoid this death by a thousand cuts that you've heard of already today, the steady degradation of these very qualities that make the river such an important treasure. I have a petition that signed by nearly 500 people asking the DNR to develop strong rules to protect the unique and significant natural, scenic, cultural, and recreational assets of the River Corridor, and we'd be happy to share that if that would be of value. So on behalf of Friends of the Mississippi River's more than 5,000 members, volunteers, and participants, I want to support the DNR's request for an extension of authority to complete the rules and publish a public notice, and I strongly urge members to oppose Senate File 39. Thanks for the time today.
Thank you for that. And members, I must make a note that there's a quorum present. And before moving on, in fairness to everybody that's traveled here, I would like to indulge the group to stick with it until we finish here. It shouldn't be more than another 15 minutes. So the next presenters would come forward. And I think there's two of them that are commissioner members. If they would both come forward at the same time, please. Peter Grove and Lynn Moradczyk. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Peter Grove. I live in the Mississippi River watershed in White Bear Township. As a citizen volunteer, former state and federal government official, and nonprofit organization board member, I've been involved in bipartisan efforts the past 40 years to protect, restore, and enhance the Mississippi River and its watershed in the Twin Cities region. As you've heard today, the common theme of these state and federal government initiatives is that the Twin Cities segment of this Mississippi River is an important resource and belongs in, to all of us and impacts all of us, not just those that are fortunate enough to live along the river, and that there is state and national interest, as already outlined by Superintendent Labovitz and Mr. Clark, in the management of this resource, and that the interests of river landowners and local units of government must be balanced by the broader public interest in this segment of America's most important river and watershed. The Minnesota Critical Areas, as you've heard, was proposed by Governor Anderson in 1973, signed into law later that year. I had the privilege of being a member of his staff at that time and was actually a member of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board, now Council, that recommended that the governor endorse the 72-mile Mississippi River Corridor that he did later in 1976. That executive order, as you've heard today, was reaffirmed by Governor Cui in 1979. I then had the opportunity to work for the National Park Service when former Senator Durenberger and the late Congressman Bruce Vento, who was a longtime member of this body, and three other members of the delegation approached the Park Service in 1979 to evaluate the significance of the three rivers in the Twin Cities area, the Mississippi, the St. Croix, and the Minnesota, in terms of their national significance. That National Park Service study was concluded in 1980 and led to the passage of a provision of Public Law 96607 that established the Metropolitan River Corridor Study Commission that asked that commission, made up of state and local officials and citizens, to look for opportunities for federal, state, and local cooperation to manage these rivers. I had the opportunity to be on that commission, and that commission in 1986 made a recommendation that was supported by then-Governor Perpich to the Congress, that the Congress recognize the recreational, historic, cultural, and economic significance of the Mississippi River in the Twin Cities area by designating it a national river and adding this segment to the national park system. As you've already heard by Superintendent Labovitz, that occurred in 1988 with legislation sponsored by Senator Durenberger and Congressman Vento and supported by the entire Minnesota delegation. And that legislation found that there was a national interest in the preservation, protection, and enhancement of the resources of this river. And as Mr. Labovitz mentioned to you, the MNRA, our national park, is the only national river segment along the entire main stem of the entire Mississippi River. The MNRA Act also created what was called the Mississippi River Coordinating Commission to work with the Park Service to develop the comprehensive management plan that Mr. Labovitz showed you earlier. I had the privilege of being appointed by the Secretary of the Interior to be the first chair of that commission. Senator Pappas was on that commission, and other members of that commission are here today. And when my term ended as chair, former Deputy DNR Commissioner Ron Nargang during the Carlson administration chaired the commission. The legislature in 1991, if you've already heard, adopted the MNRA boundary, and in 1994, the commission completed its master plan, which was approved by the secretary and the Interior. Governor Carlson, governor at that time, supported both of those initiatives. You've already heard a considerable testimony today about the request in 2007 to look at the efficacy of the current critical area program that led to a statute that was passed in 2009 and an appropriation directing the DNR to update these rules. And, of course, no formal rules have been proposed. Most of what you've heard today is based on the stakeholder process and proposed rules. But that has led to considerable opposition, as you heard today, from some along the river and certain local units of government. And my assumption is that that's led to the introduction of both S-39 and House File 95. And frankly, as someone that's been involved in this river and trying to have better management of it for 40 years, I consider these bills both a drastic and uncalled for approach that would eliminate important state-level protection for a resource of national significance and imperil the boundary of our national park. And I would urge you, instead of approving this bill as amended, that you just give the DNR the authority to continue the rulemaking process. Minnesota has a well-regarded and extensive public participation process for rulemaking that would offer a reasonable forum for fact-based, and I'd underline that, fact-based landowner and local government concerns to be taken into account on the record with appropriate judicial and legislative oversight. And that, to me, seems to be a reasonable next step. I thank you for your time today and for your public service.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Lynn Maratska. I am a former MNRA commissioner. I was appointed by Governor Carlson to serve on the commission. I represent the city of Hastings on the commission. I am a resident of the city of Hastings, and so I represent the other end of the river corridor. We see what happens to many of the things that are developed further upriver. We're impacted by those things, as well as Red Wing and Lake Pepin. So my concerns are looking at this, the whole MNRA corridor in total, looking at maintaining the rules, maintaining the critical area, allowing this process to continue, because we all have a stake in it. What happens above the Coon Rapids Dam impacts what happens in Hastings. We suffer flooding when there's more development or improper development. We look at what happens to us downriver. And so from that standpoint, I would like you to consider keeping the rules in place. Many of the communities share the river and this protection. It isn't, we're all in this together. I think what one city does affects another city, and it's very difficult to coordinate. When you look at the size of the watershed and how water is managed in the whole watershed, we are all impacted by that. And I think Superintendent Labovitz's comments about what happened in Lilydale and Mendota Heights and how water is managed or wasn't managed in those cases and how property owners are impacted unwittingly because of the acts of others. If we don't take into consideration all of the area in the watershed when we're taking a look at how property is developed and managed in the area. One of the river vitality, the whole idea of the Mississippi River, is an economic driver. It's an economic driver in Hastings. We have three marinas in Hastings just and a public landing just to manage the public access that people want to get into the Mississippi River corridor. This is an important thing for us as well. We share the river. We need to have the river as a part of our economy. We have turned the door around from Hastings and look at the river and appreciate the river as we look at how we develop in the river. But we also abide by the guidelines of the shoreline ordinances and the critical area as we look at development in the community. I served on the City Council in Hastings for 12 years. I know well what the issues are.
when the city council is looking at development opportunities within the community. And I would like to take this opportunity, give up a few minutes of my time to former Senator Ed Oliver.
Welcome, Senator, to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman, and members.
As you know, Mr. Senator, we're on a time constraint, so please make it brief and welcome again to the committee.
This is going to be very brief.
Thank you.
I have a little experience with water as my Senate district surrounded Lake Minnetonka, as many of you know. And that's another water resource. It's a major lake and with 29 miles of shoreline. And there were differences among the 11 municipalities that are around that lake. There were differences among residents who lived by the lake. And I heard many people criticize what was going on and say we had to be changed. But if you go to the broad public in your district, at least in my district, and they wanted to enhance and improve the watershed. That was it. And I believe that this legislation, which is up for repeal, would in fact enhance the Mississippi River watershed. And I would urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Oscholt and Liz Walensky, she would come forward. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm William Barton. I'm replacing Kevin on the list, if that's all right with you. I'm a member of the Breckenridge chapter of the Isaac Walton League of America. I'm also on the board of the Minnesota Division of the Isaac Walton League of America. I also serve in my capacity as a St. Paul resident on the Capital Region Watershed District, which has nothing to do with this testimony other than the fact that I'm there. And I understand the impacts of impervious surfaces on water quality. But anyway, the Breckenridge chapter, I'm not prepared as much as I'd like to be here. Our clubhouse, as I said, is located on the Mississippi River in Brooklyn Park, and we are a nonconforming site. Our clubhouse is probably 20 feet from the very, very steep riverbank. We have a stairway going down there, and we've been there since I believe it was built in 1929, and you can see the result of that on the bank from looking at the water, how it's eroded the bank on both sides where our water comes off our roof and runs down the bank. And here 2 years ago, we put in a rain garden to try to ameliorate some of this erosion of the riverbank from the fact that our building is really too close to the bank. We also own a 40-acre island in the river that was one time belonged to NSP and was given to the university, and then they sold it to us for a dollar because of Dr. Breckenridge's association with them through the Bell Museum. But anyway, and that's been left in a natural state. We have 133 members in our organization, and they're all very local to that area. And our Minnesota division has 18 chapters in the state of Minnesota, and we are very diverse. We include members of business in the farm community. Our league's members reflect diversity of politics found in our state and nation, and we have 18, as I said, we have 18 chapters in Minnesota. Our national organization represents thousands of members and hundreds of chapters, and our members represent hunting and anglers' interests, which are definitely related to the water quality issue here. Many members have a lifelong commitment to conservation and environmental protection, and the Minnesota Division has a storied history of many, many accomplishments in over 80 years of working with conservation natural resources in Minnesota. I don't know if you know, the Isaac Walton League was formed by a group of fishermen who used to come to the Mississippi River to fish when they saw the degradation of the water quality back in the 20s. We deeply care about the river, and we want to see the lands, waters, and wildlife protected. And I didn't mention that my history, I guess one thing I want in my introduction is I grew up about four blocks from the river in Brooklyn Park and spent many days as a child swimming and fishing for carp and having a good time down by the river, and I really love the river. My first job that I ever got was for a woman who lived on the river, and I was dumping her old wood pile into the river because she didn't want it anymore. But please, I shouldn't say that on the record, probably.
Try and be a little more brief.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
Basically, you know, we support periodic rules review and assessment and if needed, reform, and that's what this is, and there's a special reason here. And we need to focus on outcomes, and we would support the extension of the DNR time to finish the rules. The Minnesota Division has signed on to the MEP letter, which earlier testifier noted, so please note that. And thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for that. Ms. Walensky.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and senators, and ladies and gentlemen, for allowing me to come here today and testify. My name is Liz Walensky, and I'm elected commissioner of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. The district where I represent, my western boundary, is the Mississippi River within the city of Minneapolis. I'm here today because I would urge you not to pass this, and I would also urge you to allow the DNR to continue to go forward and present and create the rules that are needed to go an overarching area of the river. Minneapolis, particularly the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, was formed in order to protect some of the shoreline, both the river and the lakes in the city of Minneapolis, for public use. And one of the things we've seen over the last few years is it's not just our water that is affected. Our water is affected by other units of government that lie outside of our district. We have Minnehaha Creek that runs through southern Minneapolis. Minnehaha Creek starts at Lake Minnetonka and weaves through a few suburbs before it hits Minneapolis. Because the rules are inconsistent on shoreline development between those cities and the city of Minneapolis, we have impaired swimming waters at Lake Hiawatha. The creek flows through Lake Hiawatha, and for the most part, we cannot open the swimming beach at Lake Hiawatha anymore because the water quality has gotten so bad from the river, the creek that flows from upstream. Also, we are also looking now to develop a brand new park and rec system above the falls in Minneapolis. This would include an area that has been traditionally industrial, including the cement plant that was referenced earlier. We have a competition going on right now where design teams from across the country are looking at that 5.5-mile stretch from the middle of the city up to the northern boundary. All of these competition entries were due this week and will be announced to the public on Thursday. I, however, sit on the jury, so I've kind of seen them a little ahead of time. And I have to say that these competition pieces are fabulous, but they aren't just parks along the river. They're parks, and then they are housing developments and work areas and industry and things that will be an economic boon to the city of Minneapolis. However, they'll do this without damaging the stream and the shoreline so that these can be enjoyed by not just the residents of Minneapolis, but people in the whole region. These will probably be, like most Minneapolis parks along the river, regional parks. These are an asset to communities beyond the city of Minneapolis. These plans have taken into account some of these DNR roads that are being thought about because we included that document in the items that we presented to our design teams to look at while they were coming up with this. Another thing that I wanted to add is that I've heard a lot here from people who work for cities and jurisdictions, and we know that city planners and county planners and transportation people have to deal with the rules that are made by governing bodies. The fact is, everyone has to deal with rules made by governing bodies, and we all have what we call continuing education for our jobs. This is just a part of their work, and yes, there may be new rules they have to implement, but they have to implement new rules all the time. These rules, however, are not what are going to affect land prices and what aren't going to affect whether or not developers are going to do things along the river or anywhere else. What affects that is our economy. And so having rules that are consistent for an area have nothing to do with any of that. It would be better for us to have things that are going to protect our natural resource. And as the competition that we are doing stated in its overarching documents for our designers, the Mississippi River is considered the third coast of the United States and one of the three great rivers of the world, with the Mississippi, the Amazon, and the Nile being those great rivers. This is an asset that we need to protect. So I would urge you to let the DNR continue to with this process and create the rules that are going to protect this world asset. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bell, and the final testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and other senators on the committee, I welcome this opportunity. I'm Tom Bell, a resident of Grey Cloud Island. If you look at that map that you, some of you were looking at earlier, showing the designated critical area, Grey Cloud Island is down at the south end. We're just upstream a little bit from Hastings. So what the people in Hastings do to their water probably isn't such much of a concern of ours because the current goes down. But there's a lot of people above us, and we are concerned. Now, Grey Cloud Island Township is a governmental unit. I know you're all familiar with townships, but our township lies 100% wholly within the critical area. And so because of this, we have had a tremendous concern for the regulations and the efforts then that are for whatever is going to be happening to the river. And we actually, as a township and as the residents there, owe a real gratitude to the previous regulations that existed because they helped us thwart a development that was going to impinge greatly on the environmental areas that we have. If you, in looking at that chart that you have, you'll see that a lot of the Grey Cloud Island area is some of the area that is designated to be protected. It is a really valuable wildlife corridor. I personally have identified over 200 bird species just on Grey Cloud Island. Lee Fan Mueller is here. She could speak eloquently to the bird movements and the that this corridor is essential for. We actually, townships in general, do not have any full-time people. We have no full-time planners. I'm on the Planning Commission. I'm a former member on the town board. We need these regulations. We have not had any problems in being able to communicate where we have any difficulties with proposed goals and rules that are going to possibly go against what we may have in our comprehensive plan. They've been very approachable, and we feel that we've had an excellent source of being able to communicate this. I strongly urge you to defeat this proposed amendment. The river is so essential, and it isn't just the view of the river. It's a view from the river. And what people do to protect this resource is exceedingly important. Thank you for your time. I'd take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, Tom Diamond. I'm a resident of St. Paul, resident of the critical area and a business owner in the critical area. And I make my living in residential construction, so I have a real stake in what happens with this critical area. I've had the good fortune of being involved in the critical area process, including serving on the Mineral Commission with Senator Pappas. And I have served on the City Council in St. Paul and served on the Planning Commission, so I'm aware of the needs of local input. In St. Paul, this is not only a very important asset, which we cherish very much, but it's also a huge economic driver in our city. We are currently doing, and I'm serving on the task force for the National Great River Park Plan, which builds on this process. And what we have been able to do in areas like Lower Landing and Victoria Village and the Ford site are what really are going to drive our economics and our livability of our city going in the future. So it's important to have good rules to work with.
You can look at the record and you can ask DNR staff. I would say that what has been proposed as far as rules is a mixed bag. I have been as outspoken a person as anybody as the concerns about some proposed rules, and I think some other proposed rules are very sound and well managed. But that's the process. We all put input in, and that's all right. And I'll point out some specifics. You asked about, so why do we need this rulemaking process? I'll give you a couple examples. The mayor of Champlin spoke before and said, you know, we've got a concern that if you draw a line, you can't have standards on one side of a line and a different standard on another side of the line. As a matter of fact, the critical area did that. It established 30 years ago lines and what the rules were on each side of the line. Community said, you know, after working with us for a number of years, you know, maybe that line should be a little bit over here or over there, would work better for the resource and the community as far as development. The rules, maybe we should have a number, different set of districts, because the rules with only four districts, it limits your flexibility in how you protect the asset and how you allow development. So he said, we would like the opportunity to look at different lines, and we would like the opportunity to look at a wider variety of districts. That's what this process does. So what the Mayor Champlin actually was speaking for is rulemaking, even though he didn't realize it. Another one that was raised is Mark Stutterud, a wonderful business in St. Paul, a brewery. That brewery was built under the critical area regulations. And the concerns that he raised were 2006, before this rulemaking process. They were the local control, local zoning process, which everyone says, well, that's what we want to go by. That's actually what he was speaking about his concern was. As a matter of fact, in the proposed rules, which none of us have seen the final draft, but the proposed rules actually provide an exemption, which is one of the things that people said, we want the ability to have these exceptions in the rule and the proposed rules do. Another one that's in there is the executive order. The executive order requires local units of government to identify and inventory 12 to 18% slopes and 18% and greater slopes. Because of and they are supposed to work with the state agencies and the Met Council to develop those. Well, because of lack of resources, that hasn't gotten done. But it's still a requirement of communities. Part of this rulemaking process was to do that inventory, and they've been working on this. And if you eliminate it, then the resource that the communities have been asking for would be denied them. It seems a shame. The one other thing I'd like to mention to you and respond to Senator Scoy. Senator Scoy, you raised the question about the shoreland management. Shoreland management, as you well know, is required throughout the state, but has not been enforced in the critical area in some cities. It hasn't been enforced, the city of St. Paul being an example. We've urged to have a shoreland management provision, but it's never been asked by the, even though required, hasn't been, DNR hasn't implemented. In this discussion of the rulemaking, we encouraged that to be done. And they said, no, as part of the rulemaking, they tend to blend it into the requirements for the critical area, and why they haven't done it so far is the critical area requirements. So again, one of those pieces that you asked about is part of that rulemaking. So either we need to move ahead with the rulemaking, which I'd encourage you to do, and I would encourage people to have the input as to what they agree or disagree with. But walking away from it doesn't make these issues go away. It just pushes them off without the tools to be able to address them. Thank you for your time. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much. Members, that concludes the list of testifiers. Again, I thank you so much for hanging in there. Are there any questions at all of the witnesses?
We going to have, Mr. Chair, are we going to have time to have a discussion about this in the future meeting?
I'm sorry. Do you think that there's going to be a lot of discussion here? I guess I was ready to move the bill.
Well, yeah, I hope so. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Keeler.
I have to go back to my witness list to figure out. there it is. Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, one of the things I see is that one of the problems that we've had in a lot of these kinds of discussions is that local units of government are piecemealing the management of a critical area that's critical to the whole region and also the state. And I happen to have part of the Mississippi River that is by Fort Snelling and goes along the fort and has a lot of wildlife, and the gorge is there. What I find, some of the testimony was that they didn't want to follow the kinds of rules that would protect this habitat. And it's not just, you know, it's the state of Minnesota owns the water, from my understanding, and that water should be preserved. And that is irregardless of whether or not who owns the land adjacent to the water. I think what the testimony on the continuing the rulemaking makes a lot more sense in that we can get to some of the issues that haven't been addressed. I think the time frame, quite frankly, on the original bill to do it in 18 months was a little bit was a lot shorter than what needed to happen. And the evaluation of this watershed district, because of the complications that within the watershed itself that Mr. Liebowitz brought up about the different kinds of habitat just along the 72-mile corridor. One of the things that we're concerned about, and one of the things that keeps that City of Minneapolis and many watershed districts are looking into, is to try to limit the amount of stormwater runoff, et cetera. And some of these are an effort to address what's going to happen in all these communities with that, and how much impervious surface is going to allow more runoff into the river. And that that runoff accelerates water and causes more erosion. So having the idea of trying to ram this through without some of the discussions about how those questions affect the local communities and even the homeowners is, I think we need to get into that a little bit more. We basically just listened to testimony because we haven't had time to ask all the questions from all the witnesses. But
Senator Sachs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 72-mile National Park, I kind of got the flavor of the testimony that you know, the Genners were kind of on the north end, and the people for the rulemaking were kind of on the south end or downstream, so to speak. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised about that, but what I would hope is that we let this rule process go along. We're kind of halfway through here, and then at that point we can make a vote. We can take a vote at that time. If we don't like the rules. Say you don't like the rules, we don't have to approve them. So I guess I think it's kind of foolish halfway through it, just because of what we are afraid of might happen, that we don't continue on and again, then make the decision when we get those done. Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to say that I'm very happy to have joined this committee. I'm sorry I wasn't here last week.
Welcome.
I was sick all week, but... And this is quite an exciting committee meeting for my first committee meeting. Although I'm new to the Environment Committee, I'm certainly not new to the Mississippi River. I represent a large section of the Mississippi River. I lived for over 20 years on the bluff, set back from the bluff, a reasonable distance. There was a park between me and the bluff. We also, my family had a houseboat for 10 years, so we really enjoyed the Mississippi River as a recreational source, watched the barges going up and down the river. Certainly I understand that the Mississippi River is a working river. It's not going to be a wild and scenic river, although there are parts of it you should, those of you who haven't had a chance to do a riverboat ride, you should in the spring. Because there are parts, there are times when you really are amazed that you're in an major urban area because there is so much green along the river. It's very important, though, and I would oppose the bill and urge that we let the DNR complete the rulemaking process. As Senator Saxhaug said, we can revisit this later in session. We can revisit the rules at any time that we want. We can intervene and change the rules with statute. But we do need to have kind of some uniform consistency up and down the river. I think that's really important. We need rules that are common sense. We want to protect the river today and for the future, and we want developers to know what the rules are so they know what the rules are, obviously. And we see that what the cities upriver do impact those of us who are more downriver, or what we do in St. Paul certainly affects Hastings. I do believe that the state does have a strong interest here, that it should not be left totally to local control. We should be partners in this. We both want to preserve and protect the river. But people come from all over the world, all over the country, all over the state to see and enjoy the Mississippi River. We often don't appreciate what we have in our own backyard. And for those of us in St. Paul, we did turn our backs to the river, and we did have junkyards and did terrible things to the banks of the river. And we've totally turned around now and have a very beautiful riverfront, and we need to preserve that. Finally, I would just like to say that if one of the criticisms is that the DNR has not done enough listening, well, we certainly have not done enough listening to reverse the process that the DNR has spent a year doing in a two-hour committee meeting. So I would urge the chairman to take a little bit more time, allow some testimony. You know, there are a few people here from my district, but most people don't even know about this committee meeting this early in January, because I could probably, with a little notice, could fill this room with hundreds of people who want to keep the rulemaking process going and believe strongly in protecting the river. So let's not move so quickly. Let's take our time. Let's be thoughtful about what we do. There was a reason 2 years ago that the Environment Committees decided to give the DNR the authority. And this committee has never been a totally green committee. This committee has always been mixed with people who are pro-environment, pro-development, pro-business, you know, pro-citizen. It's been a very diverse committee. And I think I just would urge us to be more thoughtful.
Thank you for that. We've had a lot of testimony here, and I think you're right. You probably can fill the room, both pro and con. I think that's a pretty fair statement. However, I don't know that we're going to hear anything different than what we've heard today, quite frankly. I mean, we had a lot of good testimony, and a lot of folks came here, and I think they'd like to see that resolved. So more discussion, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a legislator who represents the headwaters of the Mississippi and has strongly been supportive of the Mississippi Headwaters Board, which had a tough run with the budget cuts, but used to work to bring uniform, strong regulations across county jurisdictions to the Mississippi because of the importance of the Mississippi to the state and the country. I think that a lot of what they're doing here is probably very good. I think the last testifier who talked about these issues aren't going to go away. I mean, you repeal this rulemaking authority, all these issues are still going to be there. The decks and the docks issues of whether they're in conforming or whether you can build them or not, they're all still there. I think that perhaps a little time to understand what the ramifications of repeal are on that and who and what authority is actually going to be taking place for those regulations would be in order, because you know, I'm pretty sure that there are some regulations that are going to take place, and they're 300 feet, I guess. And, you know, but we don't really understand that at this point. And which cities have enacted shoreland ordinances? Why didn't St. Paul enact the shoreland ordinances? You know, the gentleman from Summit Brewing really, you know, as I sat here and contemplated this, I think that if he, you know, built his plant in 98 in conformity, spent $24 million, and now for some reason he's out of conformity and can't expand, that's an issue that has to get resolved. And from what the last testifier said, he's going to have better resolution if we move forward with the rules, as opposed to if you leave the 2006 regulations in place. And so, you know, kind of for his benefit, because I really think I can't accept somebody spending that kind of money when they're in conformity and then having the rules changed on them in the middle. I think we need to understand what the ramifications are on these lands and these property owners.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, the Mississippi River is the border of my district, from top to bottom, from the northern city limits to the 35W bridge. And, you know, you talk to people, you know, up and down the streets, and some would like to have, I forget who talked about, the green corridor, you know, green from beginning to end, no buildings, no industry, no anything. Others really like to see the barges going up and down and acknowledge that we have a working river. I like to see the bald eagle that lives out on the island. I like to canoe the Mississippi River. I like going through the lock and dams. You know, it's a part of so many Minnesotans' lives. And I just think that this piece of legislation is going in the wrong direction. We have differences of opinion about how things should work. That's what we do here. We try to resolve differences of opinion and come to some resolution to them. It doesn't serve any of us well when you quit halfway through the process. And that's what we would be doing if we would be stopping the rulemaking at this point. I'm not supporting this bill, but I do have a question for Senator Cruz. In the amendment that we adopted, you deleted the purpose of the designation. I don't understand why you would take that piece out of statute. It is saying, you know, the purpose of the statute, you know, the protection and preservation of the Mississippi River, you know, the prevention of damage to this natural resource that is not only just a city but a state and national resource, one of the three great rivers of the world, as Liz Walensky told us. I'd like to understand why Senator Cruz thought that that should be taken out.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, that is taking out part of the legislation to take out the rulemaking authority. And that's the way we had this drafted. That's the way I understood that it read.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
And Senator Cruz, it has nothing to do with rulemaking. It is the purpose for the designation of MNRA.
Mr. Kanoff, can you clarify this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mr. Higgins, is my understanding that what this bill is designed to do is to put back the law as it was prior to 2009. The sentence that you're reading with the four clause or five clauses, that was added as part of the rulemaking in 2009. And what this amendment is designed to do is just to put it back the way it was prior to that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pat.
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand that. That purpose clause was in the original Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area Act. I'm looking at the copy from the statute right now. I mean, I think it might have been more the reason that the Senate doesn't do purpose clauses.
Senator Betzold isn't here anymore.
Yeah.
Mr. Kanoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pat, this was added in 2009. The language that's being stricken was added.
But, Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, I think it is. I served 4 years on the Judiciary Committee with Senator Betzold, so I kind of have gotten away from purpose statements. But this is not a purpose for the bill. This is a purpose for the designation. And I do believe that it must stay in as law. And so, Mr. Chair, I will move to, I don't remember the language.
Strike section one.
Strike section one. Yep, that'll do it.
There's a motion on the table by Senator Higgins to strike section one.
In effect, that would be putting that all back together, right. Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if the author of the bill, Senator Cruz, could let us know if that how that impacts the intent of his bill and if that makes a difference to what he's getting at.
Mr. Chairman, Senator
Cruz.
As far as impact of the bill, I think right now what we're looking for is to put it back in the state that it was before the 2000 or prior to 2009 when that legislation was passed. Impact is that we would not be doing it. Also, you know, we're looking to keep conformity, keep this clean, and there has been negotiations done right now to move this forward as is. So I guess I would speak against that amendment. I would speak keeping the language as it is so that we can get to the original intent of putting this back what it was before the 2009 legislation was passed and fall back on the original executive order.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Knapp can help. Was there anything of substance in the 2009 law except the rulemaking authority?
Oh, Mr. Knapp.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, the 2009 law included this purpose clause, which is basically codifying what was in the original 79 order by, or actually 73, earlier order than reauthorized in 79. So basically it was just taking language from that and putting it in the statutes. Mm-hmm. But that would still exist, that executive order would still exist even if this were deleted at this point.
But
Senator Higgins.
So Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, putting this designation in does nothing to your cause of repealing the rulemaking authority. And I think if you look at it and you love the Mississippi River like most Minnesotans do, you would recognize that this is something that's important to leave in statute. Even though it's in the original executive order, I think most Minnesotans would understand that this is something they all believe in.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I could not agree with you more. I do truly, from the bottom of my heart, believe that the Mississippi River is a precious national resource that we need to protect. I think that is done already. I think that whether this language is you know, essentially what I'm looking at here is why do we need to clog up our statutes with language that is more expletive, or it's more descriptive, especially when we have an executive order that already has that in place. I guess I would question, you know, what is the purpose of that? Why do we need that in there? I mean, I look at the volume of statutes that's sitting, you know, above my desk right now, and I just I would ask, what is the need for that? We have that taken care of already.
I'm sorry, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The an executive order is certainly important, but it's the governor's statement. This is the legislator's statement. So do legislators want to say that, no, I do not want to protect and preserve the Mississippi River? No, I do not want to prevent and mitigate irreversible damages to this resource? No, I do not want to preserve and enhance the natural, aesthetic, cultural, and historic values? You know, I mean, that's what you're saying, really, if you vote for the bill in this version. You know, I would urge the members to support Senator Higgins' motion.
Okay, there's a motion on the table by Senator Higgins. Would you reinstate that motion, please, Mr. Knapp?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins has moved to delete Section 1 from the bill, which would keep the language of Subdivision 1 in place. It would still contain the repealers in Section 3 to repeal the rulemaking process, but it would keep that language of the purpose of the designation in Subdivision 1 of 116G.15.
Okay. Committee, all those in favor of Senator Higgins' amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
This decision of the chair that it does not pass. However, you want this division? Okay, Senator Higgins is asking for division. All those in favor of Senator Higgins' amendment, please raise your hand. Okay, all those against, please raise your hand. The 8-6, the amendment does not pass. Senator Cruz, what's your – I'm sorry, Senator Keeley.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see if Mr. Hirsch could come back for just a couple of questions. Some of it has to do with information they gathered in the rulemaking process.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Hirsch, the original bill that brought the rulemaking process had a fiscal – you had half a million dollars to put this this rulemaking together. A couple of things. First of all, has that money been spent? And second of all, during the process, was there more research done as to what rules needed to change? In other words, evaluate the habitat and any of that information that is basically lost if we pull the rulemaking process away and not used for the actual maintaining of the critical area that's under the executive order.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kielash, there is some dollars that we have not spent yet from that appropriation. They're detailed in the fiscal note. Actually, I do have a draft of it here. I think Mr. Mueller has it too. But.
Mr. Mueller, we'll address that.
Mr. Chairman and members, there is a preliminary fiscal note, and because it's still preliminary, that's why I haven't handed it out. There's still what Mr. Hirsch will probably get to in a second here. There'll be about $150,000 of the $500,000 that isn't spent yet that would cancel back to the Clean Water Fund. the part of the fiscal note that actually isn't done is they were asking Met Council to actually review the law to see if there'd be any savings they wouldn't have to carry that for duties that they wouldn't have to carry out anymore in assisting communities after the rulemaking would be complete. So there's no cost to the bill. Actually, there would just be a little bit of savings of clean water money. And like I said, the fiscal note wasn't complete by the time we came here, so that's why I did not hand it out yet.
And then, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, if I understood the second part of the question, the information that we've developed, that we've analyzed during the rulemaking process is still available. It's public information. Whether we're able to go forward with the rulemaking process or not, that information would be available to be used if it could be.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hirsch.
Follow up.
I'm curious as to what kind of information are we talking, biological land use, what kind of information was gathered and during the course of the rulemaking?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
I think I might have to have Mr. Berg. Okay, couldn't better you. Answer that question than I can. Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator. As part of the rulemaking process, we analyzed a lot of things. So we visited communities. We analyzed comprehensive plans and ordinances. We did a natural resource evaluation. Part of the role, as one example, we were required under 116G15 to do water quality analysis. So we work with water organizations as an example and see what their rules were and then incorporated some of their suggestions in our rulemaking. So that's one example of some of the environmental issues that we addressed as part of these rules.
One more time. And that is – my question is that it, with the new rulemaking parts that you have done, is there any of that research that you've done that would make it critical for – make it environmentally stronger with the new rules that you put in, discoveries that you found that made it – that added to your rule changing?
Mr.
And critical or
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator, using my previous example on water quality, so the executive order, in the 1970s, that was the origination of, Federal Clean Water Act, for example. So water quality rules were new. Now, in the 2011, we're much more sophisticated in water quality rules. So, yes, they're up. Are updates from, if your question was, is there updates from the executive order that we're operating under now to what we have in the draft rule? Yes. That would be one example of where there are updates.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a very significant issue, and I think this is really the first I've heard much about it. I really do think we're moving too fast, and I guess when in doubt, vote no. I'm in doubt, so I really think we should be taking some more time to find out more about this before we...
I'm sorry, I was out of order. Senator Peterson.
Yes, I was just going to make a comment and a motion in regard to this bill. Generally speaking, I think our constituents are better served when decisions are made at a local level. You know, based on that argument, and I hope as an example, the things we might hear in the future that our constituents are better served by representatives elected locally rather than here at the state, I would make a motion that we move Senate File 39, which is a bill relating to the eliminating of the Mississippi River critical area, repealing Minnesota Statute 2010 Section 116G15 to the Senate floor for consideration.
As amended?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like a roll call vote on that.
Thank you, Matt.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
We're a finance committee. This has a fiscal note that we haven't seen yet. We would not be doing our due diligence if we would send this bill out of here without seeing that fiscal note. We're in a kind of a new world here because we've got the policy and the finance. So I don't believe our work is done, and I don't believe our work is in order to send it out of here until we see the fiscal note. And then the correct motion would be to send it to the big finance committee, not to the floor, because it has a fiscal effect. So, Mr. Chair, I would move that we would table this bill, which is a higher motion. It's an undebatable.
Senator Higgins moves that, I'm sorry, what was the motion?
To table the bill.
It's not debatable.
That's not debatable. So at this point in time, take the vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Nay.
That's the determination that the nays won.
We don't think we should have a division on that. That was awfully close.
Would you like a division?
I think I would, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins has requested a division. All those in favor, raise your hand. All those against, same sign. The motion fails. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The point that Senator Higgins brought up, it could have some validity, but I'm wondering, it doesn't cost us any money. It's a savings. The fiscal note is about, the question is, how much savings would there be? So it would be a positive impact in that sense. So I don't know what all the rules are as far as that goes, but it wouldn't be an expense to the general fund.
Thank you for that, Senator Gerlach. That was going to be exactly my comments as well. There appears that there might be, at least preliminarily, a savings of $150,000 of the $500,000 that was expended. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, having been a budget chair for 8 years, customarily even bills that are savings still have to go to the Finance Committee because they still have to be reconciled. Because that money, that savings is either going to apply toward the deficit or it's going to be used somewhere else or, you know, it still has to be accounted for. It just can't be hanging out there in limbo.
Well, that's a point well taken, Senator, but I think what we need to do here now is move on. I don't think we're looking at any kind of an expenditure. It's been the fiscal analyst's determination that there's not going to be any more expenditure should this bill pass. Should it go forward, then we'd be talking about actually expending some more dollars. So, Senator Carlson, then we're going to
thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard testimony that the money came from a dedicated fund and it wouldn't apply to the general fund, so the fiscal note would be irrelevant.
Clean water.
No, we still keep track of money.
Fiscal notes are never irrelevant.
Fiscal note.
But we still keep track of the money.
Fiscal notes are never irrelevant.
Sorry, Mr.
That's true. That's true. But I think we've had plenty of testimony here. I think everybody knows which way they're going to vote here. With regards to my thought, we've had testimony on both sides here, both pro and con, very, very good, concise testimony. I don't think anybody's going to change their mind if we postpone this another day. So Senator Peterson renews his motion. to move forward with passing Senate File 39 as amended. I guess there was a roll call requested. Please take the roll.
Senator Carlson. Yay or nay?
Yay.
Senator Dames.
Yes.
Senator Gazelka.
Yes.
Senator Gerlach.
Yes.
Senator Hall.
Yes.
Senator Higgins.
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Senator Kielash.
No.
Senator Langseth.
No.
Senator Miller.
Yes.
Senator Pappas.
No.
Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Saxog.
No.
Senator Skoy.
No.
On a vote of 8-6, the bill does pass. Anything before the committee, the rest of the committee? If not, we're stand adjourned. Thank you for the extra 15 minutes, by the way.
Winona,
sure does. For local control, Senator Pappas.